This is the Canadian Baseball Network Podcast, in partnership with the Baseball Zone. Here's your host, Matt Betts.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to episode 2 of the Canadian Baseball Network Podcast. Last time we spoke with a player and a coach. This time we're taking a look behind the scenes with one of the most well-known Canadian scouts this country has ever seen.
Yeah, it's going to be a great guest we have on today's show, Matt. Walt Burrows, who's, you know, been around the game for a long time in so many different capacities in scouting. He's seen so many different players in Canada and really all around. And I'm really looking forward to this, not just from, you know, a fan's perspective, getting to hear scouting and how it all works and sort of the ins and outs of it, but I think a lot of our audience will too, whether you're a coach, a parent, a player yourself. I think you're really going to get a lot out of this, really sort of give you some perspective on what, you know, a big league scout really thinks and how it all works.
Yeah, I think parents and players growing up and in their high school years are really going to enjoy this one, because kind of go behind the scenes of what the scouting process is like and what they look for, and a ton of great stories that I'm sure he has from, you know, scouting Canadian greats over the years.
Absolutely. And let's hear the interview between Matt Betts and Walt Burrows.
All right. I'd like to introduce our guest today. If you've been around the ballpark in Canada, you've probably come across him at some point. He's seen and evaluated just about every major up-and-comer this country has produced. He was a supervisor of the Major League Baseball Scouting Bureau in Canada and is now an area scout for the Minnesota Twins. Walt Burrows. Walt, welcome to the show.
Nice to be here.
Awesome. So I think this scouting is really a captivating topic among, obviously, young players and families. So I just want to ask you, how did you first get into scouting and what attracted it to you? Was it something you knew you were always going to be interested in?
I had no clue. I played locally, grew up in Victoria, played local baseball there, went to a U.S. college after high school on a scholarship and played, and my studies weren't the best. I returned home and started coaching youth baseball, and that's kind of how the scouting thing it evolved out of my coaching at the youth baseball level.
Yeah. So how did you get involved with the Scouting Bureau at the time? It was 1991, correct?
Well, it's kind of a fate thing. And yes, it was 1991. At that time, the draft wasn't in Canada. And in 1991, it came. And at that time, the Major League Baseball Scouting Bureau that was in the United States at the time, because the draft was going to include Canada, decided that the Bureau should be there as well. And Tom Volk was the first supervisor, and that was in 1991.
Okay. And then, so tell me a little bit about the Scouting Bureau. Obviously it's not around anymore, but tell me a little bit about how it worked and kind of your role in that.
Well, it was the central scouting agency for Major League Baseball, similar to the NFL, NBA, NHL have the same thing. So it's the scouting is basically the same, but instead of sharing your thoughts and reports internally with individual teams, they go to all 30 teams. And I think in Canada, because there wasn't as many scouts up there and the players were basically diamonds in the rough, hidden out, that the Scouting Bureau was a big asset to Major League Baseball to identify those players that wouldn't normally have been seen.
For sure. So obviously you've, you know, scouted numerous players, big leaguers, but I have to ask you about an interesting one that you scouted, Steve Nash, you know, the professional, obviously professional basketball player. Can you tell me a little bit about how he got on your radar and how close were you to getting him to switch to baseball?
Well, I don't know how close, but I brought it up. The relationship goes way back. Steve's from Victoria, where I'm from. And he's the same age as my brother's son. So they basically played various sports together throughout the years. And my older brother, Don, coached Steve with Steve's father through Little League. And then after that, Steve played like it was basically high school baseball back in those days. There wasn't any of the elite programs at that time. And he'd given up baseball kind of in his senior year of high school and was playing soccer and basketball. And he was such a good athlete that I thought that he'd be a better baseball player. And I actually saw him. My brother called me. He kind of put together a fall league and said that Steve and his brother Marty were playing, that I should come out and see them because they were really good. And I did. And I called Tom Volk, who's my supervisor at that time, and said that, like, I've got this really great player. He's a shortstop. And, of course, Canadian shortstops, there's not a lot of them. And Tom was really apprehensive, and I kind of went on and on and on about how good of an athlete was and how good of a player I thought he was going to become, that Tom relented and said, okay, I'll come and see him. When can I see him and what team's he on? And I told Tom, there's two problems. He's not going to be on a team next spring. And he's not going to play baseball. So that kind of ended that discussion, but I didn't leave it there. I visited Steve in his last high school basketball game in the McKinnon Gym, which was famous for the University of Victoria Vikings that had national championships, and the Ken Shields was the Olympic team coach, and that team was based out of there. And so I visited Steve at the McKinnon Gym and basically told him that he had no chance being a basketball player other than playing for his country and maybe in Europe. And in baseball, he was going to become like an everyday shortstop and make millions. So I was right about the millions part. I was wrong about the sport. But today, I believe he would have been an everyday big league shortstop with the skills and all the things that you see in basketball. He basically did the same things on the baseball field.
Yeah. So speaking about his skills, give me a quick scouting report on him. What kind of player was he? What were his strengths?
It was his makeup, you know, like, and he just did everything naturally. You know, like he wasn't fast, but he was quick. His anticipation to things happening before they happened were uncanny. And he had a good swing. And I just thought all those pieces put together that his game would out kind of play his tools. And tools are kind of the individual things that you looked at. And I would say that in basketball, like he wasn't a great shooter in high school, but he was he could see the court, and he was kind of like Wayne Gretzky on a basketball.
Have you seen him over the years? And has he ever mentioned that to you?
You know, I haven't run into Steve. I ran into Steve actually 4 years later at the airport. I'd become the supervisor of the scouting bureau at that time. And, I was flying to Toronto, and the plane that I was going to get on came from Toronto, and off the plane there was Steve in the Victoria Airport. And we had a nice chat and whatnot, and his final comment to me was, thank God I didn't take your advice 4 years ago. And he was actually coming to Victoria to pick up his parents, or to meet with his parents to go to the NBA draft, where he's the first rounder with Phoenix.
That's an amazing story. Yeah,
I have run into his dad and his mom. I see them on occasion in Victoria, and they always remind me how wrong I was about their son.
Yeah, I think that worked out though for him. I would say he's okay with his decision.
Yeah, great guy and great guy, great family.
Yeah. So to jump kind of to your current role with the Minnesota Twins, can you kind of take me through again? I think parents and kids growing up, they're so interested in the world of scouting. Obviously, you want to get scouted. You want to get the eyes on you. But what kind of are your responsibilities day-to-day with the Twins?
I cover Canada still, but I also do pro coverage. So if there's we cover the other team's minor leagues, so I get some coverage there. And as well, our organization is big on having more than one opinion. So players are identified by the area scout, and then we kind of pile on with other area scouts, supervisors, cross-checkers, scouting directors, And so I get to kind of see players in other territories to add an opinion to build kind of a portfolio, a full portfolio on the player.
Yeah. So how many days would you say you're on the road? And another question for that would be, what's your favorite city and ballpark that you've been to?
Probably, like, I would guess like around 200 days on the road, maybe not quite 180, 200 days, something like that. Stay in a lot of Marriott hotels. Favorite city, hard to say, you know, like, I don't know, like it, like I don't go for vacation. If it was for vacation, probably Halifax, or Montreal, Quebec City. And, you know, there's been ball players that have come out of there. I kind of like, you know, I guess favorite park, like I have, like in Canada, there's a small ballpark in Courtright, Ontario, that's an amazing place. Sir Roxman Stadium in Nanaimo is really a good park, and probably a favorite for seeing players and identifying talent would have to be Connervale Park in Etobicoke there, where Joey Votto, Don Hill, and many others came out of.
Yeah, Connervale is definitely famous around here for sure.
Yeah.
So to further understand what being a scout is like, and to kind of give an insight into, you know, what the scouting world is about, can you kind of take me through the different times of years for a scout? So how does it change from right after the draft into the fall, winter, spring, and then obviously leading up to the draft?
Well, if you looked at a business cycle, the draft would be the year end, basically the close of the year. So kind of starting like right after the draft, and actually even through the draft, but you're basically, once the draft ends, you're going to build your list of players for the following drafts and beyond. And so you go to events, tournaments, what have you, tryout camps, and you identify players in the, like up through the baseball season, like in Canada, it would be at end of October. Basically, you've kind of put your list together there, and then you would do kind of in-home kind of things, scheduling, that sort of stuff in the off season to be ready to go to see those players in the spring, to see whether or not they're better, worse, bigger, stronger, or whatever. And then you follow them. Some are a lot better, some aren't quite so good, and other players pop up along the way there, and even younger players to kind of add to the list before you need for the years following that.
Yeah, so I think that's an interesting point. So how, obviously I'm sure it's not a set number, but how big is that list you're creating after the draft for the following year's draft? And then how far down the line would you look past the following year's draft?
The list varies year to year. It depends on the territory that you're in. But you know, like in Canada, generally, I would say probably like serious follows. Like there's always kind of like maybe this guy, but the guys that you really need to see, there's probably like 25 or 30 kind of going into the draft. And again, players fall off that list and players take big jumps and get added to that list. And then at the end of the day, kind of right into the draft, there's probably like maybe skill isn't everything, you know, like the makeup of the player, his desire to sign or to go to school comes in the play. And there's other players that have skill but lack polish, so to speak, and they're better off going to college to develop them and come out better prepared at a later date. So, you know, you might think, hey, you know, like he's certainly, you know, has the tools to play, but he doesn't have the kind of the polish or the survivability to kind of go right away. And that's, you know, like, geez, you know, like this guy's really good. And he goes to, like, Cal Quantrill is a good example. Cal certainly could have gone into professional baseball out of high school. He was skilled enough. He had the survivability, but he thought that he would be better served going to college. And, it's hard to, you know, like, and he would have been fine in professional baseball, but his path probably was quicker to the big leagues going through to university at that point in time.
For sure. So speaking on kind of on that point, how do you kind of judge, you know, the ceiling of a player opposed and separate that from the results that are being put up? Is that, do they go hand in hand, or do you kind of separate those?
It's really a great question. You know, the, like, we kind of identify tools and without that, that's hitting, power, running, throwing, and fielding kind of individually, and you package that together. But in the game right now, if you don't hit, you basically don't play. And so as we watch players, there's not that many Joey Votto's, Justin Morneau's, Tyler O'Neill's out there, but there's players that become that. Like a good example would be a Jason Bay, who, like, I saw in high school, thought other parts of his game were better than his defense. Like, he was the third baseman when I'd seen him. And it turns out he was a pretty good hitter in the least. So he developed in college. Like, a great example right now, probably the best one for your audience in Toronto, would be Jordan Romano.
Yeah.
In high school, he wasn't an aggressive pitcher. He was just trying to figure things out. Like I wouldn't say he wasn't competitive, but he wasn't anywhere near as competitive, say, as a Cal Quantrill in high school and a lot of other guys. Like, he was just kind of feeling his way out. And now, years later, he might be one of the most competitive pitchers in all of baseball. He did, you know, like, I'd be lying if I saw any of that in high school.
Yeah, no, for sure. So how do you balance
that development process?
Yeah. So do you kind of, there's some guys that obviously you probably see that never develop that in college. Do you kind of see personality traits among guys that you think can get to that point? Or is it just kind of, you're not interested at the time of high school and you follow them throughout?
You know, if you don't have the competitive makeup, you know, like, it's really hard to survive in this, especially through the minor league grind, because you're not playing in stadiums. You know, you're out on a backfield. It's, you know, like, if you're with the Blue Jays or the Twins, you're down in Florida, it's 100 degrees, it's really humid, it's, you know, there's nobody watching, and you can really feel sorry for yourself quickly. And so you have to grind through that process. So that's a big part of the makeup. And, you know, you really have to love the game and think that there's upside and chance to get there.
Like, yeah.
Like kind of a guy that comes to mind, again, another Toronto guy would be Pete Orr. You know, like, tremendous makeup, had lesser skills and tools, but maximized what he had and had, you know, like I don't know, like 7-8 years in the big leagues, you know, a lot with the Atlanta Braves, and scored that winning run in the Pan Am games, you know?
Yeah. I think that picture of him kind of kneeled over home plate is etched in my, is burned into my memory, which is, which is a good thing.
You won't find a better makeup player. And if Pete didn't have that makeup and drive, he would never have made it, because the schools wouldn't have taken him there.
So those are all great points and all great examples for the people listening. Question for you. This is probably a question that a lot of coaches would ask is what is your routine when you get to the ballpark? What are you looking for? When do you start looking? All that kind of stuff that goes into, from the point that you get to arrive at the ballpark to the point that you leave.
You watch, we like our saying in scouting is you scout them coming off the bus. So, you know, they get to the park, you know, you look at athleticism first and foremost. Like a guy like Steve Nash, athletically, obviously is going to stick out. You look for strength, you know, like and movement. A guy like Tyler O'Neill would stick out. You look for enthusiasm. A guy like Pete Orr would stick out. Physicality, Adam Loewen, Jeff Francis, Justin Morneau. Those things stick out immediately. And then, you know, like once they kind of get on the field, you watch how they throw. And that's the first thing that they do after they warm up is they play catch. So you watch for how their arm works, how the ball carries while they're throwing. We get into an elimination kind of thing with that. So when you throwing is almost like skating in hockey, that if you don't skate, it's really hard to play in the NHL. And if you don't throw, you better really hit them and hit them a long ways in baseball to have a chance. So you eliminate positions on the field, like if you can't throw. And then you watch running, you watch the way they swing the bat, bat speed, bat strength, and not so much results. You know, that you know, like if you've got a slow, long swing, you'd probably be a great slow pitch hitter, but you need quick hands, hand-eye coordination, and bat strength to impact the ball and ultimately, you know, like hitters play.
Yeah. So would you find that's a, I don't want to say a misconception, but the whole results-based analysis, is that probably one of the biggest things that people don't understand, that don't see into the world of scouting?
At the amateur level, yes. And the lower amateur level, what, like the numbers start to play out as you get into, like in Canada, you know, like the elite programs, you know, you have the Langley Blazes, Okotoks, Vauxhalls, Toronto Mets, Toronto Blue Jays, Great Lakes Canadians, like performance starts to happen at that level. In Quebec would be the Academy of Baseball Canada. And in college, certainly numbers play out, but before that it's the swing and the strength and basically the ability to put the bat on the ball, but like the good hitters hit, you know, like there's very few players that in my time in Canada that you saw that you just knew that, you know, like whenever you walked in, you didn't hope that they were going to hit. You just knew they were going to hit because they did all the time. And that's the Morneaus and the O'Neills and the Bottos and the Brett Laurie's of the world. They just hit. Josh Naylor, Bo Naylor. They're really special guys.
Yeah. As soon as you start talking about that, the first one that came to mind was Josh Naylor. You know, no matter what level he went to, he was hitting. So that's
I've got a great story about Josh.
let's hear it. Let's hear it.
I was actually at this is the first time I laid eyes on Josh. I was actually at a Canada Cup tournament in London, Ontario. And I'd watched a couple of days and, you know, like I'd seen kind of the guys that were there, the competition, the level of talent that year wasn't great. And I asked, and I said, is there anything going on in Ontario that's worth seeing? And the guy I asked, not really much, but there's I think it was the OBA Bantam Elimination, I think they called it. And I said, where's that? I'm in. And they said it was at Ninth Line Park out off of Dundas there. And so off I went and I drove in. It was like the middle of August. It was hot. And if you've ever been to that park, it's not green. It was burnt not long around the field. Dust kind of walking in between fields. And I kind of leaned up against it. I had no clue who was playing anybody anywhere, but there was the two fields were being used and there was games going on. And kind of the park on the right, as you walk in, I kind of halfway down the right field line, just kind of leaned over the fence and I was watching. And this chubby kid came up to the plate. And he was batting left-handed, and I think he was 14 or maybe just turned 15 years old. He hit a home run out of that park, and that's a full-size field. Like,
yep.
It's like 310 to 410 feet in center field. Like, this young kid hit a home run. I went, wow. And so anyways, like, the game kind of went on, and he went over to first base, and he reminded me of Prince Fielder. Like that, maybe that's what Prince Fielder looked like at that age.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great comparison.
And so anyways, the game kind of went on and it was close in the end and they brought him in to pitch to close the game. And you know, like I kind of wandered back there, he was throwing 88 miles an hour again as this young kid. And I'm like, holy mackerel, this kid's like really good, but he didn't look the part, you know, like he wasn't, you know, he was, you know, he didn't know what way the body would go. Like I say, he was 14 and 15 years old. So anyways, as fate would have it, Greg Hamilton, the coach of the junior national team, called me, and he had his team in Toronto. He collected them in Toronto before they were going to Italy to train for the World Championship, which I believe was in Taiwan. And he called me and said, hey, is there any chance you can put together a group of kids to play the national team? We've got a couple of days off here before we leave. So we get a couple of games in. I said, sure, I can do that. And so I thought about it. And I called him right back. I had this idea. I said, Greg, why don't I put together a group of younger players that might be part of your program down the line? And you guys, you know, you could talk to these young kids and maybe, you know, like let them take infield, outfield, that sort of thing with the junior national team kids for something like a goal for them to aspire to be, to play on the junior national team. It's a great idea. So anyways, I called Josh up. He was one of the players that I invited out. So the story gets better. We're out there, and Josh was going up for his very first at bat, and the Seattle Mariners had let a kid by the name of Logan Seifert play, and Logan had signed with the Mariners, and the Mariners loaned him back basically to the junior national team to play in the World Championship. And Logan, he threw 92, 93 miles an hour. And Josh got in the batter's box, and I don't know if I've never asked him this question, but I think because he, like, well, I, no, they played on regular diamonds, so that wouldn't be the case. He got in the batter's box, and his back foot was in front of home plate, and his front foot was outside the batter's box. And I said, Josh, like, this guy throws pretty hard, you know. And he goes, oh, no problem. He's got the same kind of thing. He kind of taps the plate and twirls the bat. And Logan wind up and threw him a heater in there. And Josh turned it around. And if you've been to Connerville Park, it's 404 feet out there in right center field. He hit the ball like about a foot below that on a line.
That's unbelievable.
Greg come over like, who's that? I said, well, this kid I saw a few days ago. And then he said, do you think he can hit left-handed pitching? I said, I've got like no idea. And Greg brought a left-hander in that had been drafted by the Baltimore Orioles in the fifth round. And he said, you know, can you make sure he hits against him? And Josh hit a one-hop double off the left center field off of him. Greg visited Mrs. Naylor, Janice, and Josh was on a plane to Italy a couple of days later as part of the team program. So
I was waiting for you to finish that story to hear if he got on that plane to Italy.
he had some passport problems. They had to iron that out, but it was a couple of days later he was there. And that didn't take great scouting. It was fate. Like, Josh Naylor would have been found very soon thereafter, I'm sure, but it's kind of neat that he was part of the national team program and one of the better, like if you ask Greg, I'm sure in his top 10 all time of players that have been part of that program.
For sure. So how often does that happen that you show up to a park, you know, looking at somebody and someone else, you know, catches your attention for some reason?
Well, another story, I'm good on stories. The first time I saw this player, a friend of mine that was a big part of the reason that I got the scouting, when I come back to Victoria, he would say, hey, let's go to some games tonight. And there's like about six or eight parks in Victoria where they play youth baseball. And again, like, this is kind of into the Premier League years, but in the early part of that. And so we basically go to each park and watch the half inning end, and then watch the players run on the field, watch them play catch, the pitcher warm up, and then we'd get in the car and drive to the next park, kind of looking for like enthusiasm, size, athleticism, you know, like, or something that really stood out. And so we're at this park in Victoria called Topaz Park, which is kind of a converted soccer field. That was one of the parks where kids played. And these guys were 14, 15 years old. And we were walking into the park, probably like 500 feet away from home plate. And I could see a left-handed batter in the batter's box as we were walking towards the plate. He hit a ball into the gap and he was running. And I said to my friend, I said, like, wow, that kid looks like he can really run. So we kind of walked into the park and you know, the inning ended and I was hoping that he was going to go to shortstop, but he actually went out to center field and he was playing catch with the left fielder. And he, like, normally kids just kind of lob the ball in between him. These are like 14, 15 year old kids. And he was just really throwing, like he was throwing seeds to the left fielder. And I said, my friend, it's like, wow, it looks like he can really throw. So the umpire said ball's in, and their dugout was in the third base side. And the first baseman, there was a big kid playing first base. The first baseman threw the ball hard to the third baseman because that's where their dugout was. And I said to my friend, wow, it looks like he can really throw too. So we've got a center fielder that's small that can run and looks like he can throw, and a big 6'3", 6'4" kid at first base that can throw because we watched with that one throw a ball across the infield. It turns out that the first baseman was a kid by the name of Vince Perkins, and Vince Perkins was drafted by the Orioles. And I think the Blue Jays was a 40-man roster guy with the Blue Jays. I wish I could say he made it to the big leagues, but came real close. The center fielder was actually Rich Harden. Rich Harden was part of the Fab Four. They called him in Oakland, of Zito, Hudson, and Harden.
Yep.
I think one of the best arms, like his numbers were unbelievable as a starting pitcher with the Oakland A's. And that was the first time, I'm from Victoria, it was the first time I saw either one of them. Was wandering from park to park in Victoria that day.
For sure. So you're talking a lot about what, you know, some people may call like the eye test. You're watching them play. Obviously, if you're watching a big league game now, it's you can't even get through it without hearing about analytics. So I kind of want to ask you, how has the scouting game changed as analytics have been more ingrained in baseball?
It's still like it's everything still starts with the area scout. But that's, you know, like, and then through the, like, the extra looks at our organizations as supervisors, cross-checkers, like, it all starts there. But now the analytic, again, like, further up the food chain in terms of where you're at, there really is no analytics in high school baseball or in Canadian baseball at the high school level, or high school age level. So it doesn't play that part there. But if you're in a college, then it plays a big part. So it, you know, like you pass the eye test, the tools and the makeup stuff, the analytics come in to reinforce that or poo-poo it, you know, like reject it. So the analytics, the spin rates, the Rapsodo data, all exit velocities, all that kind of. Oh, you know, like you saw him hit the ball hard. Well, this is proof that he does. Where you see the swing and miss of that fastball. Well, you know, there's a spin rate or movement attached to that you can see on paper.
Yeah. So that kind of leads me to my next question. As a Twin scout, who is, I say, favorite or best signing that you've had with the Twins?
Well, Jordan Balazovic is definitely it. He's the number three prospect within our organization, and he's in the top 100 of MLB. So he's done well, and he's projected like we hoped. Like Landon Leach out of the Toronto Mets program, we'd signed. He was a high draft pick. Still highly believe in Landon. He's a big, strong kid. Everything works, but he's had arm issues to deal with. And so he's kind of on a longer range thing. He's just kind of coming back off of that. So have high hopes for him as well.
Yeah. So when you take those guys, you know, the two that you mentioned, anyone really that you're scouting, you really believe in, how much of a push does it take from you to your, you know, supervisor to get them actually drafted? Because obviously it's an investment for the team. If they're going to sign them, it's a monetary investment as well. So like, how does that process work when you really believe in the guy?
Well, you really believe you kind of state your case and everything, like all the scouting things that you see and the projections of where they are now, where they're going to go, that makeup, the survivability through the grind plays a big part in that belief. And then the other scouts, like top to bottom through our organization, have to buy in as well. Like have to like see the same, or like I might be really high on somebody and they're not. And that's part of the process too. You know, that there's guys that I like that think that will become really good that other people don't. And that's kind of the same thing with like the analytical part, this, you know, that has to reinforce who we take out of those bigger programs and other eyeballs in our scouting department have to basically do the same thing. You're not going to get them if you're just the only guy.
For sure. So let's jump to draft night. So obviously I feel like the higher end guys are a little bit more obvious, but how much do you know going into the draft, like the actual draft itself, about guys that you've recruited and that might get taken?
You know, we talk about it, you know, that, you know, that like basically we stack players from top to bottom in the amateur draft. So we see players from San Juan, Puerto Rico to Victoria, British Columbia, everything there and in between. And all our scouts, you know, like we write multiple reports on them. They're cross-checked by everybody. And then at the end of the day, there's a pecking order from one through, you know, like probably 600 or 700. And then, you know, we have pre-draft meetings, there's video, there's statistical analysis, and, you know, you talk through and you adjust the list so that you're ready on draft day, and then you away you go from there. You like you've talked signability, you like you know who wants to sign, like who's leaning more towards college, and that kind of factors into it as well. And then you start taking players, but you don't know what the 29 other teams are going to do, and so that list gets, you know, like on the fly adjusted. I don't know how long it is from like your first pick to your second pick, but there's a lot of adjustments made, you know, like from the time that you pick until the time that you pick again. And with the way the rules, they might change with the new collective bargaining agreement, that if you don't sign a player within the top 10 rounds, you lose that money to apply to another player. And so the signability has to be pretty much carved in stone. Like, I don't know what the percentage is, but I would guess it's probably 98% of the top 10 round players sign.
So how tense is that on draft night? You know, well, you don't really know what's going on, or is it kind of like you've done your work and that's all you can really do?
Yeah. You know, like you've done that, and you know, like those top players, obviously you have your general managers and scouting directors are calling their agents and whatnot to make sure that the deal is in place before they do it. Those players are probably receiving calls from other GMs and scouting directors. So there's play in there. And so, but it's a quick negotiation, you know, that the deal has pretty much firmed up before you sign off on it.
Yeah. So I have to ask this question, and I'm sure you've been asked it a million times. Who is your biggest miss as a scout? Some guy that you weren't high on that went on to have a really good career.
You know, it was early and you know, like he wasn't developed, but it would have to be, you know, Jason Bay, you know, like for sure. But I don't think he was ready out of high school. And you know, like, so I had no idea that he would ever become rookie of the year when I'd seen him. And Jordan Romano, like, would be another, like, he's, I don't, like, as a baseball guy, you know, like, he would rank, he has to rank in the top 10 closers in all of baseball right now.
All the Blue Jays fans would love to hear you say that, and I can't say I disagree.
You know, that he's awfully good, that's for sure. But, like, there was no indication that either one of those players would go beyond a, like, a college career to becoming, like, all-stars, rookie of the year, and a closer, which is, like, a whole different competitive mindset.
For sure.
That was nowhere visible in high school. And I'm sure if you asked Jordan that question, he would say the same thing.
Yeah, it's just so interesting how that happens and how development takes different times for different players and all of that.
You know, the lesson to be learned that is that both of them had a love and desire for the game and wanted to play regardless of where things led. They just wanted to be the best they could be. And as it turns out, you know, like it turned into greatness. You know, like Joey Votto was the same. Joey was drafted as a high school, his first time he was eligible as a high school eligible player. And, you know, like arguably in his best days, you know, like the best hitter on the planet, and played at a Connervale Park, and who would have thought, you know, like, and I'm hoping, fingers crossed, that he's a Hall of Famer. Certainly a case for that.
Yeah, there's absolutely a case for that.
But a real good grassroots thing for parents that as he was growing up, he just liked to play.
Yeah. No. So sticking to kind of high school, who was the best high school player you've ever seen? And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, went on to a great big league career, but just at the time, do you remember who the best high school player you were at?
Without question, Adam Loewen, fourth overall pick with the Baltimore Orioles. He would have been a first rounder as a pitcher. He was a first rounder as a pitcher. Would have been as a hitter as well. I think he hit 700 in the World Championships with the under 18 thing. And I compared him to Steve Carlton out of high school. He could do it all, like big left-handed, threw hard, great curveball, great competitor, and great arm action, great delivery. And as fate would have it, ended up breaking his elbow twice. He did make it to the big leagues as a pitcher and as a hitter. And there's not many in history that have ever done that.
Yeah. And that's some high praise for
extraordinary talent.
Yeah. So one last question for you, and it's just kind of a general question. What advice would you give to players and parents as they go through, you know, the high school years of playing baseball? Obviously, there's more and more, you know, seems to be pressure on these kids, more and more showcases to go to, these elite teams. What kind of advice would you give to them as a scout and someone who's seen so much in your career?
It probably sound corny and simple, but the first thing is a real love of the game, staying within your lane. Like what do you do? Just try like Jason Bay isn't Josh Naylor, you know, like do what you do best, and enjoy it, you know, like, and when you go to practice, work on the things that you do, but work harder on the things that you don't do as well. You just never know, you know, Rich Harden and Josh Naylor of who's going to be there that day that you're there or that you're playing. And there's college recruiters, there's guys like myself that go, and I actually like going when nobody knows I'm going and not sitting behind home plate, just kind of watching the game and see how they play. So like, if you don't enjoy it, you're not going to, you know, like at the end of the day, you're not going to put the work in and effort in that's taken to maximize your talent. Like I can remember seeing Mike Trout play, was doing pro coverage. He was on a AA team in Little Rock, Arkansas. And we like to watch like five or six games in a row of a player play. And I had double up games. So I ended up getting to see him like in the four teams that I was covering, like about 11 times. And I never saw him once jog to first base, you know, like hit it and peek and jog. It was like 100% effort, like every game for the 11 games I saw him play, and I remember calling Bob Elliott and telling him I thought I'd seen Mickey Mantle. And the last line of my report was that he's not going to be here long, which he wasn't.
No, I think that's fantastic advice. And I guess it's true what they say, that you never know who's watching.
Yeah. Well, you can't manufacture stuff. You know, you've got to take the piece that you're given, work really hard for it, and excel at it, maximize what you have. And it might be only that you're a good player for the Etobicoke Rangers. It might be you're a great player for the St. Louis Cardinals, or a great closer for the Toronto Blue Jays. But the great ones usually, you know, they have that in the corner of their eyes, but they really enjoy the ride, and they really enjoy the work that kind of goes into the process that nobody sees, which is on those, you know, mom and dad, you know, like at the concession stand, or like dad playing catch, that leads into the greatness, or as good as you can be, which is all that you can be in the end of the day.
For sure. So while I thoroughly enjoyed this conversation, I really appreciate you joining us, and we'll talk soon.
Yeah. Hey, my pleasure.
Have a great day.
Let's hope that there's another great one coming along soon.
I think that's the word to describe that interview. So many stories about so many Canadian greats that Walt has scouted over the years. You know, you look at the story about Josh Naylor, he goes to a ballpark just to watch. It's the Bantam tournament, and he finds Josh Naylor, and before he knows it, he puts him together for a team to play against the junior national team. And by the end of the day, it seemed like he was on a flight to Italy joining that team for the World Championship. So really great insight from Walt. And, you know, you don't hear these kind of stories every day.
No, you sure don't. And one thing that stood out to me was just how he talked about, he wasn't afraid to talk about how he was wrong about some players too. Jordan Romano is a great example. He talked about how, you know, in high school, he certainly didn't see him becoming the Blue Jays closer, you know, on a team that won 90 plus games this season. And I think it really speaks to just how every player has their own unique path. You know, we hear that all the time, you know, whether it be you're listening to other podcasts or you're listening to industry experts, but to hear it, you know, straight from a scout himself, it was really interesting to see, of course, with that Canadian perspective as well. And, you know, anytime you see a Canadian head into the Twins organization, you'll sort of know a little bit more behind the scenes now about how that all plays out.
Absolutely. And I think it's just so interesting that, like you said, take a look behind the curtain and see what that process is like, because so many young players and parents are so interested in being scouted and recruited by, you know, whether it's professional scouts, college, whatever it may be. So to kind of see how that process goes about and that there are misses out there and there are late bloomers out there, I think that a lot can be taken from this conversation for players that are watching or, you know, want to make that jump to the next level.
Yeah, for sure. And it's really exciting too, just for, you know, our audience out there, parents, coaches, players themselves, whatever it is, you know, be sure to take lots away from that. And more than anything, we really hope you enjoyed this discussion today between Matt and Walt. You know, we also, of course, thank Walt for taking the time out of his very busy schedule. Of course, he's down in Arizona right now. We really appreciate him taking the time to talk to us and give us a ton of great insight. He also said he has a ton of great stories that he didn't even get to, of course, because we don't have all day, of course, but definitely going to want to get him back on the show at some point here. Right, Matt?
Yeah, for sure. And you know, we could have talked for many more hours, but, you know, if you're looking for more Canadian baseball content, make sure to check out the CanadianBaseballNetwork.com. Obviously the news never stops. So right through the winter time, the off season leading up to the spring and summer, the Canadian Baseball Network has you covered.
Thank you for listening. Be sure to check out Canadian Baseball Network for extensive and comprehensive coverage of the latest in Canadian baseball. And The Baseball Zone, Canada's leading instructional baseball academy and training home to thousands of MLB, pro, college, and youth baseball players. We'll